Well, I hope you had a good afternoon. I saw that some of the ladies were here still working for VBS. And by the way, guys, if you just are completely out of something to do tomorrow about, let me look, about 10 o'clock, then if you see what David has been building out here, in our side yard here. And I'm going to have fifth and sixth graders out there, and we've got to spend the morning sanding that with sandpaper. And so if you just run out of something to do, have about 25 fifth and sixth graders I need to keep out there for about an hour and 20 minutes sanding that, okay? So I might need a little help if you just are completely out of something to do. Then you can come and enjoy that with me. Turn to Luke chapter 1. And so we've been reading our New Testaments together, and you have by this time certainly read through this section right here. But I'd kind of like to go through it a little bit different way. How many of you have a special way to eat an Oreo cookie? Huh? Let me see your hand. Okay, be honest about it, man. I'm not going to ask you what way that is, but you like to eat it that way, right? And it may be a little bit different. By the way, one of the things, as I made numerous trips to Belarus and got to know families over there and work with kids, at least part of that time also, and starting a Christian youth camp over there, then I would ask the kids on my next trip, what would you like for me to bring? And two things popped up. One of them was Oreo cookies because they've heard that's Americans' favorite cookie. And the other was peanut butter. And peanut butter is heavy. And, putting a few things of peanut butter in your carry-on or in your luggage certainly adds to the weight of it. But my son-in-law, he's been here, I think they've visited one time with us, Stephen Fitzhugh, who's the coach at a Christian school in Monroe, grew up eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And I suppose lots of folks did that. I wasn't one of them. I grew up, my mother cooked three meals a day. And we working on the farm, I guess we could eat like that. But he pretty much grew up on peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And through college, he didn't even go in the cafeteria very many times because he kept peanut butter and jelly in his dorm room, and he ate that every day. And he was happy to eat it. And so he was just really didn't quite know what to do when he got married and my daughter cooked. And he just thought, well, if you cook a couple of meals a week, then that's a lot. But she did differently than that. But I have had a lot of fun watching him teach his children how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And I didn't know that there was an art to it, but he seems to feel that there is. And I won't describe the whole thing, but it's just really kind of strange. It has to go on a certain piece of bread, the piece of bread that goes up or goes down, I don't know which one. The peanut butter goes on one. It has to be spread a certain way. I've seen him stop his son, my grandson, when he was making one, say, "Son, that's not the way to do it," and take the knife away from him and redo it, and show him how to make one. And so the grandkids being at my house, I like peanut butter okay. It's not a staple food item for me, like he seems to think it's one of the basic food groups. But I decided I would make some for my grandsons when they were there one time. And so I made a couple of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and gave them to them. And the oldest one took a bite of it as he was walking off, and he turned around, and he came back and he handed it to me, and he said, "Papa, I can't eat this." And I said, "What do you mean you can't eat this? Why?" He said, "And by the way, if I'm going to eat peanut butter, I like it crunchy." He said, "This has got seeds in it." He had never had crunchy peanut butter, and he didn't like it. So anyway, he wouldn't eat it. We had to get whatever Jif or whatever kind it is. I don't remember. But I'm more like the waitress in the commercial. I know you've seen it. The guy calls her to his table, and he shows her his sandwich, and he said, "I didn't order mayonnaise on my sandwich." And she picks up the top, and she takes that piece of that slice of bread, and she rakes that mayonnaise off on the side of the table and slaps it back on there and pushes it back to him. Well, I'm kind of that way. That's more of the way I eat sandwiches. But we all have certain routines that we develop in life over time, and interestingly, we may get to the point that we begin to depend on those routines. I have an older friend who's a rancher in Oklahoma, and he's pretty structured in his life is quite an understatement. He has the same thing to eat his whole life. I mean, Mondays, there are three different things that he eats for the three meals. Tuesdays, there are three things. Wednesdays, all the way through. There's not one single meal that's a variation. And he won't have it any other way. And as a result, he won't come over to anybody else's house. If you invite him to come over and eat, he won't come over. He will stay for church functions, but he won't eat. He waits until he gets home, and then he eats what he's supposed to have to eat. And tonight, in about 30 minutes, when church is over, he will go home, and of all things, he will have two hot dogs. And it's been that way for many, many years, and it will be that way tonight. And when he finishes eating his two hot dogs that are prepared in just exactly the right way, then he will have a slice of cake. And that slice of cake will not be eaten on a saucer or a plate. He has plastic placemats that he has to eat his cake off of that plastic placemat. And he'll also have a bowl of ice milk, not ice cream, because it costs too much money. And he's only worth several million dollars, he's not going to waste it on ice cream, but it's going to be ice milk. And every single meal is that way. I do remember one time that his wife and his daughter-in-law went Christmas shopping, and here they are in this Eldorado Cadillac, downtown shopping, and when it gets lunchtime, they're not going to spend any money on a meal. You have to understand that. They don't eat out. And so when it got to be lunchtime, they went back to the car and opened the trunk and pulled out cold egg sandwiches and ate them in this Cadillac downtown. And that was their noon meal. To say that their life is structured is something of an understatement. But we all have certain routines. And probably some of us don't really recognize it so much. We don't think very much about it until somebody brings it to our attention. And then we think, well, there's nothing wrong with that. And there is nothing wrong with that. Most of us live at least some portion of our life in a weekly routine. And that's the way Zacharias was in Luke chapter 1. And you can kind of follow along, read along as I'm talking along with you if you'd like. Zacharias, once upon a time, left his house one morning, his quiet, orderly house, I might add, because there were no children there, and he walked through his peaceful neighborhood after he had eaten his breakfast, only one egg because Elizabeth was concerned about his cholesterol. He took the same route to work each morning. He saw the same sights. He heard the same sounds. He smelled the same smells as he was walking his way up the hill to the temple. And as he approached, he noted the crowd was already outside, involved in prayer, waiting for the purification rites to be completed so they could enter the temple and worship. And it turned out that on this particular day, it fell his lot to be the one to burn incense in the holy place for purification. And he always enjoyed that unique smell. And it was a unique smell because there was no other smell quite like it in the whole world. If you go back to Exodus chapter 30, verse 34 through 38, you'll be reminded that God had given them the formula for that particular incense that was to be burned in the holy place, and he forbade them under any circumstances to ever mix incense in those same proportions or using those same ingredients for anything else. And so that was an absolutely unique smell. And he loved that smell. There was no other smell like it in the whole world. He quickly busied himself with the kindling and the preparations for the table of incense, and it was a little gold table that was 18 inches wide, 18 inches deep, and 3 feet high. And while he was busying himself in those preparations, for some reason, something caught his eye, and he looked up to his right. And what he saw took his breath. A little earlier in heaven, I wasn't there, but it took place. The Lord had called Gabriel to his side, and he said, "Gabriel, I've got a task for you this morning." And he told him when to go, where to go, and exactly what to say when he got there. And he was right on time. He appeared on the right side of the altar as Zacharias was offering or preparing to offer the incense. And Gabriel knew exactly what would happen whenever he did his appearing act. It always happened. Every time you see him, his opening line was always the same. It wasn't hard for him to memorize. He said, "Do not be afraid." Every time he appeared, it scared people. I have a couple of friends who are dentists, and I've talked to them over the years, and it's not quite as bad as it used to be because dentists don't hurt you as much as they used to. And those you young folks, you don't know what you miss with that slow grind on your tooth whenever they were working on one. But dentists don't hurt so much anymore, but they used to hurt. And both of my friends told me later in their life that if they had it to do over again, they wouldn't have become dentists. And I said, "Really? Why?" I said, "I know you did well financially and stuff." He said, "Yeah, but everybody hates to see you, and the kids are afraid of you." Well, I wonder if Gabriel didn't. It's kind of like Gabriel's job. Every time he appeared, he just terrified everybody, and everyone froze. And so he always started out the same: "Do not be afraid." And his message to Zacharias was, "Zachariah, you and Elizabeth are going to hear the sound of little feet at your house." And Zacharias said, "Right. Do you know how old we are?" And Gabriel said, "Because you didn't believe me, you're not going to be able to speak for the next 9 months. Until that child is born, you're not going to be able to speak again." Now, I don't know about you, but I would have liked to have been at his house when he came home and he started making sign language to his wife, explaining to her that they were going to have a baby. That'd have been pretty interesting to see, wouldn't it? How he got that, how he communicated that an angel had appeared to him and what the message was. And now he couldn't talk, and so he had to use his hands and, rock a baby or something, and, he had to get that across to her. A little more than 5 months later, now I'm down in verse 26, beginning. God tells Gabriel, "If you can remember your line, I've got another job for you. Got another place I want you to go." And there was a young girl by the name of Mary who was going about her daily routine also, maybe going down to the community well to replenish the family's water supply, maybe dusting around the house, maybe going to the market to buy some cucumbers, probably all the time thinking how handsome Joseph was. And she could see his calloused hands because he worked in his father's shop. And she and Joseph were soon to be married. And he was the best-looking young man that she thought she had ever seen in her life. And suddenly she was startled to hear a voice that said, "Greetings, you who are highly favored." And she was terrified, trying to think of what in the world it could possibly mean, highly favored by whom. And Gabriel remembered his line. He said, "Don't be afraid, Mary," verse 31 through 33. And then he told her that God had something really, really special in store for her. From the very beginning of time, God had promised that this was going to happen, and she was going to be the one that God had chosen to bring his son into this world. And you stop and think about it, that's a lot to put on a teenage girl. I mean, she's going to be pregnant, and she's not going to be married. It's going to be hard to hold her head up, isn't it? People are going to talk. And they're not going to believe the story that she might try to tell them, are they? I mean, after all, would you believe it? If it were someone today, would you believe it? And so I'm sure there was lots of difficulty associated with that. And she said, well, how is this possible since I'm a virgin? And the response was, nothing is impossible with God. And some short explanation was given to her. Gabriel knew exactly what to say and how to explain this news to Mary. And so she said, I'm the Lord's servant. If that's his will, then that's the way it'll be. Zacharias couldn't believe that an old man like himself could have a child with an old woman like Elizabeth. And Mary couldn't believe that a young woman like herself could have a child without a man. But she did. And Elizabeth, whenever she comes to visit in verse 45, congratulates her for her belief. And the verses between verse 46 and 55 is called the Magnificat. And it's called that because that's the first word in the Latin translation of the Latin Vulgate of these verses right here. And Magnificat means glorifies. And that's the first word of it. And so that's why it's called that today. And it's really an interesting, it's kind of like a psalm. It says that the people who come expecting to eat and be well taken care of are going to leave not understanding why they didn't eat. And the people who are poor and don't have anything to eat, the hungry, they're going to get fed. And it's a psalm about the unexpectedness of God. And how God does things really unexpected. And you can read that for yourself. We won't read it, but it's a song about surprises. And read it with that in mind sometime. And then after Mary had visited Elizabeth and after she left, and she had stayed until Elizabeth was in her ninth month, shortly after Mary left, there was another surprise beginning in verse 57, this child, John, was born. And all the relatives and all the neighbors that were thrilled about Elizabeth and Zachariah's new baby boy being born, they were all there and they were all talking at the same time. And they were speculating about what the boy would be named. And they all unanimously concluded he'll be named after his father. And Elizabeth spoke up and she said, no, his name will be John. And they said, John? Where are you coming up with the name John? There's nobody in your family named John. And so they argued about it. And Elizabeth said, well, go ask Zachariah. So they went to Zachariah and they asked. And Zachariah, of course, still couldn't speak. And so he somehow fashioned out the letters Iota, Omega, Alpha, Nu, Epsilon, Sigma. That's John. Doesn't sound like John, but that's John in Greek. The boy's name is going to be John. One of the relatives back kind of out of hearing, it was Aunt so-and-so, I don't know her whole name, but she said, imagine that. Where in the world did they get that name? There's nobody in our whole family that's ever been named John. Elizabeth finally has a child, and at her age, and they pick a name that's never been in the family before. Nothing surprises me anymore. Can't you hear the conversation about how they're talking about the child's name? Meanwhile, back in Nazareth, we're in Luke chapter 2 now, the prophet said that Jesus would be born in Bethlehem. But his mom is a long ways from Bethlehem. In fact, she's about 65 miles away from Bethlehem, and it's about time for the child to be born. And they went out to the mailbox one day and opened a letter, and there was an official letter from the government. And it said, in those days, Caesar Augustus has issued a decree that a census will be taken of the entire Roman world. And then it goes on to say in Luke chapter 2, and everyone went to his town to be registered. And whose was his town? Who was his? Joseph, wasn't it? And Joseph was of the lineage of David, and Bethlehem was David's town. And so they journeyed to Bethlehem so that the census could be taken, and the Bible continues, while they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son, and she wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no room for him at the end. And then out in the fields, there were shepherds. And shepherding is pretty routine stuff. I mean, one day is pretty much like another. You might be in a little bit different location, but pretty much the same thing happens. Now, oh, there were some of the old shepherds who had some stories, and they'd talk about some breaks that had happened in a routine. They'd talk about the flood of 49. And they, one of them would say, well, I tell you what, it was just a month past Pentecost, and the biggest lion that I've ever seen in my life came up out of those thickets out of the Jordan, and he told his story. And everybody sat around. They'd heard it over and over before. And another one, when he couldn't wait till he got through, and they said, yeah, but you know, I had my flock in a gully, a dry gully near Hebron, and a rain came up and caught me, and I barely got my, and he tells his story, you know, about how he narrowly escaped with his. And but most nights and most days were pretty much routine. But one night, just outside of Bethlehem, the sky lit up as bright as noon. And they looked up and they saw an angel hovering over them, just above them, and they were terrified. But Gabriel knew his line, and he said, what? Do not be afraid. I've got some incredibly good news. The Messiah has been born in a manger in Bethlehem. And suddenly, it says, a great company of heavenly hosts, what happened was God called all the other angels together and he said, hey, this is a really special occasion. I want you guys to go down there and join Gabriel, and I want you to teach those shepherds how to really sing. And they heard a choir sing like no human ears have ever heard before. We have some really beautiful singing here, but I have a strong suspicion that our singing doesn't touch the singing of angels, don't you? And I'm looking forward someday to hearing that. But from now on, when these shepherds are present, nobody else is going to try to best them with the story, because they've got the best story of all. Nobody can outdo them. Luke chapter 1 and 2. How many times have you read it? So many times, maybe, that it's become routine. There's nothing routine about it at all. It's full of surprises. God is a God of surprises. For with God, nothing will be impossible. Surprise is God's standard procedure back then, and it still is today. You see, when you let God take control of your life, then you need to expect some great things to happen. And to the degree that you turn your life over to him completely and trust in him, to that degree, great things will happen in your life. Because God is a great God, and he does great things. You might end up going to a mission field somewhere. You might end up like one young lady that was visiting here with us today, just recently graduated from college, and she told me that she's going to India as a missionary. I said, well, are you going with a group? No, I'm going by myself. I said, that's interesting. When you let God take control of your life, big things happen. You might end up talking to your neighbor and bringing them to Christ. God's a God of surprises, and things that you think can happen, God can cause to happen. You might end up being a preacher, or you might end up being a preacher's wife. You might end up being a song leader, or a Bible class teacher, or an elder, or a deacon. most of the guys and ladies in these positions didn't know a few years ago that that's what you were going to be. But you turned your life over to the Lord and you let the Lord do some things in your life that you didn't know that He could do. And you certainly are doing things that you didn't know that you can do. Ruth Herndon tells a story in her book, Let Nothing You Dismay, about an absent-minded older woman who mistakenly sent the wrong gifts out at Christmas time. She purchased, it seems, a heavy pair of wool socks for a poor friend named Hilda, whose substandard house was always cold. And she picked out a fancy lace nightgown for her attractive granddaughter. And by mistake, the granddaughter got the socks and Hilda got the nightie. The giver was horrified. She thought her granddaughter was going to think she was old and senile, and she feared that Hilda would think that she was mocking her plain ways with this fancy gown. And a short time after Christmas, the older woman received two letters in the mail. Her granddaughter was exploded with gratitude about the fashionable ski socks that Grandma had sent, and Hilda's letter was ecstatic. Nobody had ever given her such a beautiful gift. She said, I put it on every night and dance across the rough wooden floor, and for the first time in my life, I feel pretty. But you see, God doesn't make mistakes. He knows exactly what He's doing, and He knows exactly what you need. And so our response is, never say no. When God puts an opportunity before you, it probably will terrify you. But never say no. God knows what He's doing. He knows where He wants you. He knows what your talents are. He knows what your abilities are. And He gives you opportunities to use those. And so when God puts an opportunity before you, as much as it may cause you to tremble, say yes. I will try. I'll give it my very best. And you can't imagine what God will do with you if you let Him take control of your life. Let's stand and sing.